Well, greetings once again to all of Turdville. This is your pal Turd. It is Thursday, I don't even know what today is, the 13th, I guess, of November. And it's time for another A2A webinar. Today, couldn't have a more timely guest, a man who is very influential in the gold and silver community, a pioneer in some sense, and really a very strong advocate for everything that we all believe in. I'm talking, of course, about James Turk. James, most of you are familiar with him. He is the founder of the terrific website bullion storage and I guess sales company goldmoney.com. He is no longer the chairman there, but he's still on the board, so he still has his fingers on the pulse of that company. But now he's an author and a speaker. His latest book called The Money Bubble and What to Do Before It Pops, he co-authored with John Rubino. You've heard me talk about it before. You see a link here on this podcast page to it. I would give it an emphatic thumbs up. All you got to do is click that link. It'll send you to Amazon, and you can get yourself a copy. James, before I talk everybody to death, I just want to welcome you back to A2A. How are you today?
Yeah, really great. It's always great to be with you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And we really do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to address our questions here. I think before we just dive right in and get started, like I said, we've got a lot of questions already piling up in queue, and I've got four or five that were emailed to me. But I want to start with a couple of mine. Mine being the operative word here. Let's start with the miners. Just talk about them specifically. The hedge funds, the banks, whoever or whomever, whichever, have driven the miners down to 5 and 6 year lows, sometimes 10 year lows in some of these things specifically. And a lot of people are wondering, you know, is there a point of stress here where these miners stop producing metal beyond that which they need to produce just to keep the doors open, to keep the doors of the mines open? What do you think about the miners in general at this level? I mean, are we, like I said, we're back to levels not seen in 6 years and in 10 years. And would you be an accumulator of some of the shares here, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would be. You know, they just are unbelievably cheap. The way I look at them is the price of the miners compared to, you know, gold. In other words, I look at the XAU index in particular, because it's got a record going back to the 1980s, and calculate it not in terms of dollars, but in terms of how many ounces or grams of gold it takes to buy the XAU. And normally it's about 6 grams of gold is a good buying territory, and when it gets up to around 10 grams of gold, that's an area when the miners are overvalued. We're down under 2 grams of gold. This is historic. You know, we've never been this cheap before. So, you know, if you believe that gold's 5,000-year history as money doesn't end today, you got to believe that, you know, the miners still have a future. And given these huge levels of undervaluation that we're seeing, I would accumulate. I would be buying some miners if you're prepared to take the risk of, you know, holding shares. But you have to do this. I always like to distinguish, Craig, between what's bullion and gold bullion and gold miners. They're two different things. You know, gold is money. Miners are an investment. And when you're looking at investments, regardless whether it's miners, Exxon, Apple, or, you know, any other equity, you have to go through, you know, various steps. You know, what is a management team? What does the balance sheet look like? What is the assets of the company? You know, is it, you know, technological property, or is it a piece of land in Nevada that's full of gold? And then you have to look at things like political risk. And all of those issues. So, you know, there's a level of risk that you have with the mining companies that you don't have with bullion, because they're two fundamentally different things. So, yes, if you're inclined to make an investment, take a look at the mining companies, because they are unbelievably cheap.
Diversification would seem to be the key, that's for sure. And like you said, I think even just general traders that don't have an affinity toward the metals at all can look at a historic correlation like that and see a move that is so far outside of the bounds of normal that it's bound to correct back into normal at some point, you would think.
Yeah, I agree. And diversification, even when you're in the mining companies themselves, makes sense. And what's worked well for me in the past is you have about 50% of your portfolio in the majors. You know, these are the large mining companies that are producing, many of whom are paying dividends. Then you have the mid-tier. You know, maybe you can put like 30% in the mid-tier producers. These are smaller companies, but are still producing, generating cash flow, and many of them are paying dividends as well. And then you could put, you know, say 20% in what I call the pre-producers. These are companies that already have identified and developed a piece of property and know that they have a resource there, and that in the right economic environment, right political environment, that resource can be turned into a mine. And by diversifying in this way, you're getting good exposure, but in a conservative way, to the mining shares. Mm-hmm. You know, the big producers will just chug along and be subject to the gold price. So as you go down the list, though, to the pre-producers, you are getting companies that are actually creating wealth. You know, they're taking a piece of dirt and turning it into a profitable gold mine.
Yeah.
So diversification is an important element.
Excellent. I really appreciate you laying out that strategy. And I know there are a lot of folks listening going, that, you know what, that makes a lot of sense. And there are a lot of folks that maybe haven't even owned miners before. They've just watched them go down over the last 3 years that are thinking about getting involved. And that's you laid out a great way to get started. I want to kind of move on to, if I might lay out a theme that I've been following here in my work over the last, especially the last couple of weeks in particular. And that is that the paper price, the COMEX trading paper price, has been driven almost exclusively by changes to the dollar yen. Well, in almost every market these days, they're all electronically run by algorithms and computer trading programs. And so the dollar yen moves and gold moves tick for tick with it. It has created, it seems, to be a rather uneconomically stable paper price that physical must be delivered at, because physical has to be delivered at the paper price for the paper price to remain relevant. So we're seeing now some stresses. One of those stresses are the London forward rates, the GOFO rates, that are as low as they've been in 15 years. You talk about this often. You write about it often. What would you have to add? Is that an anecdotal bit of evidence that there is physical stress in the system, or how could you explain what the GOFO rates are?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's anecdotal. I would say it's a direct evidence that there is a serious physical strain in the physical market for gold and silver too, I might add. It's just that the SIFO rate, the silver forward rate, isn't reported anymore like it used to be, but it's also in backwardation. And I see it, you know, I'm sitting here in front of my screen looking at quotes directly from a bank, and spot is 3 to 4 cents higher than silver for December delivery, as an example.
Yeah.
So you've got spot price higher than the futures price. You don't see this on the COMEX, though, because the COMEX is just a paper market.
Right.
And you really hit the nail on the head, Craig, when you said that the relationship between the physical market and the paper market really rests on the ability to deliver physical against these paper promises. And that, you know, that's the thing. We have to recognize that physical gold is a tangible asset. Paper gold is a financial asset based on someone's promise to deliver, you know, their capacity and willingness to deliver. These are two fundamentally different types of assets, two fundamentally different types of markets. They just happen to intersect at the price that is being quoted around the world. And increasingly of late, the COMEX market is becoming less and less relevant to what's actually happening in the gold market, because COMEX is just a pure paper market.
Yeah.
It's been that way for decades, because when Roosevelt confiscated gold in 1933, the physical market moved to London, moved to Zurich, and it's never gone back to the United States. And if anybody wants to take delivery of a reasonable size of physical metal, you can't do it in the COMEX. You really have to do it in the European markets. London, Zurich, and to a certain extent now Singapore and Hong Kong are also developing a big physical market because of the insatiable demand we're seeing in China. But what we have at the moment is we see an actual backwardation. Like I was saying, the spot price is above the future price, but it's even hidden in a way, because if you were going to buy, say, $50 million worth of gold, in a normal market, you would buy it, you'd get delivery either 1 or 2 days based on the clearing mechanism that you use to actually take delivery of the physical metal and make payment for it. But now, if you're buying that kind of amount of metal, you really have to wait for a while. You can't get delivery in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And you have you know, you have a lot of jawboning from the bullion banks, basically saying, well, we could do the deal, but you're going to get the gold in, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or whatever it happens to be, depending on the size of the transaction. So we're seeing, and in my experience, an historic moment where gold is so cheap that the paper market has forced it down to a level where there's just not enough physical metal around to satisfy the demand for physical metal. And if you recognize that in monetary theory, it's impossible for gold to go into backwardation, you can understand how cheap gold is, and secondly, how much government intervention there is in the market. In theory, it's impossible for gold to go into backwardation in a market that has no government intervention. That we've seen such huge and deep backwardation suggests that, you know, governments and central banks are all over this to try to keep the gold price from rising.
I guess I'm going to use that as a segue into the first emailed in question. It comes from Angela, who sees this as well. And we're all waiting for, I mean, it may happen. It may have happened last week. I've noticed that direct correlation with the yen, though still there, there's kind of a gap that has opened on a kind of a relative basis between the two just since Friday. So we might have reached the point where physical can't be delivered at the paper price, somewhere down 1140, 1130, 1150. What Angela's wondering is, I mean, it obviously could be lower than that. So without thinking that there could be a price signal, she wants to know, you know, this tipping point, this breaking point, is there some other type of signal that you'd be looking for that would indicate the pending disconnect or that we're right upon the doorstep of the final, that disconnect between paper and physical?
Yeah, you know, this is a really good question. It's something I think about all of the time. What will happen is the market will be completely destroyed. You know, Ludwig von Mises, who is, in my mind, the greatest economist of the 20th century, said that governments will destroy the market process long before they ever understand how it works. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing here is the market process for gold bullion trading being destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, gold's basically been in backwardation since QE3 was announced back in December of 2012 and really started becoming more pronounced starting in January 2013. So this has gone on for a long period of time. And what it's suggesting to me is that, you know, central banks and central planners are destroying the capitalist system. We know that to be the case because they're forcing interest rates down to zero. And when they're doing that, they're destroying savings. And savings and production are the backbone of the capitalist economy. So to me, it's no surprise that economic activity is weak around the world. It's because you're destroying the capitalist system, you're destroying the market process. So, you know, the implications of Angela's question are really quite profound because, you know, gold ultimately might be, if it were a free market, at a much, much higher price, but government capital controls, government intervention might continue to prevent that happening for a period of time, or they might, you know, impose capital controls or confiscate gold yet once more.
Yeah.
That's one thing that every individual has to think about and plan for because, you know, gold is, in the 20th century, gold was confiscated by Lenin, Mussolini, Hitler, and Roosevelt. Why did they do that? They did it because they wanted to take money out of the hands of the people and put it in control of the government so that central planners and central planning could not only control the economy, but control the lives of each and every one of us. So we're facing something here that, in all reality, I think is going to be quite significant, and we can't really predict how it's going to unfold. But there is one fundamental thing that we always have to remember, that at the end of the day, there are two kinds of wealth. There's financial wealth that's based on promises, and there's real wealth like gold and silver, you know, tangible assets, farmland, timberland, whatever. And whenever a credit bubble pops, at the end of that credit bubble, the farmland, the houses, the timberland is still going to be there.
Right.
That tangible asset is what's going to be used to get us into a new period of growth once the credit bubble pops and that's behind us. The profound thing, though, Craig, is what the political implications are going to be as all of this, you know, comes to the fore. because the markets are broken, and either we go back and get government out of the market process, or we basically go the way the Soviet Union went.
Yeah, I think we both fear, and probably everybody listening to us, that the most likely outcome is some authoritarian type direction rather than a freedom and liberty direction. But
yeah, that's the scary thing.
Yeah,
and that's again something that everybody has to think seriously about. Where they want to live, what kind of environment they want to live under.
Yep.
And what they can do to prevent that happening, and always to take those steps necessary to make sure that they and their family are protected come what may.
Right. I want to move on to the next question. This comes from Bill, and it's kind of on the same lines. His question addresses opacity or opaqueness of the whole pricing structure, in that already London is, opaque as it is, in terms of getting delivery information and how much gold they actually have there. As it certainly appears there, the banks are living off of flow, not available stock in the vaults. We have this announcement now that the LBMA is going to stop publishing GOFO rates, just like they stopped publishing SIFO rates. The GOFO rates are going to go away at the end of January. We've had the recent news just this week of UBS having to make a settlement in Switzerland regarding their manipulation. So, some of us would think, gosh, naturally, these markets should become less opaque then because of the regulator oversight and the fines, but instead we're going the different way. So to that end, I guess Bill's question is, he saw an article on GATA that maybe there might be a class action suit, maybe by mining companies, given this, the declarations of manipulation by these regulators. What do you think the chances are of some type of lawsuit by miners versus the bullion banks that have been manipulating price, now have been proven to be manipulating price for years?
Yeah, there is a lawsuit working its way through. And the name of the firm is, I believe, called Montague and Berman, based in Philadelphia. It's a class action suit. And it's claiming reparations from everyone who has damaged or incurred losses because of the fixing that was going on in London, mm-hmm, in terms of price manipulation of bullion. But to my knowledge, the miners, the mining companies, I don't believe any of them are participants, okay, in it. The mining companies, they've shot themselves in the foot so many ways. It's really quite silly and sad. First of all, back in the 1990s, they did all of this forward selling, and eventually, as the gold price started rising, a lot of these companies incurred big losses. Some of them went bankrupt and disappeared, and then they, sponsored the World Gold Council to create this exchange-traded fund, which is really just a paper product for trading gold. It's not a way of accumulating physical metal, The World Gold Council itself, which has been supported by the miners, has gone off in a direction that really hasn't looked at gold's fundamental purpose, really, that it's money. They've looked at these other things, jewelry and whatnot, and those are sideshows compared to, why gold has value.
Sure.
Gold has value because of its usefulness, and its usefulness is economic calculation, in other words, measuring the prices of goods and services over long periods of time, preserving purchasing power, safe haven. These are all monetary characteristics of gold. So, the miners have really, to a large extent, there are exceptions. There are a few companies that truly understand their product, but most miners and most companies don't understand their product. These guys are mining engineers. They don't understand money or finance, and as a consequence, they haven't really willingly, grasp what's going on to defend their product, and it is quite sad in my view.
Frustrating for a lot of us.
Let
me move on to Marco's emailed in question, and it kind of gets to, I guess, maybe what you've seen at Gold Money. He may not realize that you're not, intimately involved in the day-to-day operations there anymore, but Marco just wondering if you have any thoughts on the current physical demand, at least as seen through the the in and out of the doors of gold money. But then he also wants to know if there's been any selling, you know, if you sense there's people selling, if there's people kind of capitulating and providing metal back to the market in exchange for paper money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I'm 67, and you know, I retired, stepped down as chairman of Gold Money a year ago, but I still remain on the board. And I still do follow the gold markets for a variety of different reasons. There are two types of buyers in the gold market. You have the accumulators that buy when gold is exceptionally good value, and you have the trend followers that buy when, you know, gold is in an uptrend. Asian buyers and a number of European buyers and some American buyers too tend to be accumulators, but most Western buyers tend to be trend followers.
Mm-hmm.
So you get, you know, different levels of demand, because in a bull market, the trend followers far outnumber the amount of accumulators. So even though the accumulators stop buying, you know when the price is in a big uptrend, or tend to slow down their buying when the price is in a big uptrend, the trend followers more than make up for it and continue to drive the price higher. So you're actually seeing, you know, really good, you know, accumulation of physical metal. You have to remember that every day, 8 tons of newly mined gold is put into the market. So it's sort of like a, you know, imagine, you know, Apple computer its shares being diluted every day by the equivalent of 8 tons, you know, in terms of dollar amounts. That's what the market has to absorb. And the market is absorbing that easily. And not only is it absorbing it easily, it's digging into some of the existing stocks.
Right.
But the stocks are not coming from strong hand individuals. Those stocks are coming from central banks. And the question is how long can the central banks continue to feed this insatiable demand for physical metal before they finally throw in the towel? And, you know, I don't have the answer to that question as to when it will happen, but I do know it will happen because it happened before. It happened back in the 1960s when the central bank cartel called the London Gold Pool eventually was feeding so much metal into the market at $35 an ounce that they had to stop because they would have emptied their vaults completely.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of situation we're in at the moment. It's sort of like at the end of the London Gold Pool in March of 1968, that there's just so much physical metal being soaked up at these levels that it's eaten up that 8 tons a day coming from the mines, but it's also draining down stocks from central banks. And eventually the central banks are going to say enough is enough. And hopefully that's going to happen soon.
It's a great segue into Chris's question, which is about the Swiss Gold Initiative, which is coming up for a vote here in about 2.5 weeks. You have excellent Swiss connections, which makes you sound like an international man of mystery, doesn't it, James? He's got Swiss connections.
No mystery.
But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, there's getting to be an almost hysterical anti-SGI campaign that comes from the Swiss National Bank on down through the politicians and the media there. What's your personal feeling? Does it have any chance? Because SNB may claim that they have paper gold obligations in their vaults, that they have, you know, that they still have 1,000 metric tons of, I guess, warrants and leased out documents showing how it's been leased and it's still theirs. I don't think they have any gold left of clear title, you know, that they actually own. But that's just my opinion. What on this point though of the SGI? Do you think it has a chance? Do you think there? I mean, we could get a yes.
Yeah, I think it does have a chance. And this is really a big, big deal for the gold market, and it's a big deal for, you know, currencies in general, because it's bringing a lot of visibility, to the issues that are causing, you know, currency volatility and currency problems. So it is a big deal, and the fact that the powers against it would go to the extent of closing the Swiss Gold Initiative's PayPal account,
yeah,
is an indication of how seriously, you know, these guys are lined up. But by law, they can't argue against that in Switzerland. They just have to take a neutral position. So the most they can do is They trot out the bankers and the central bankers and tell them why they're against it. You know, Swiss has this tradition of sound money, as does Germany since the Second World War as well. Switzerland, of course, goes back many, many generations beyond that. And it started changing in the 1990s in terms of their views. And Switzerland joined the International Monetary Fund back in the early 1990s. And when that happened, the value of the Swiss franc really started being adversely affected. And it's continued to be adversely affected by decisions tying to the Swiss franc to the euro, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And people in Switzerland understand, how inflation has been picking up since 1999 when the euro was initiated. They also understand that, the Swiss's guarded neutrality has to a large extent been impacted by, monetary decisions that are being made outside of Switzerland. The ECB, in effect, is controlling what's happening to the Swiss franc. So I think there's a very good possibility that it could pass. It has to pass two ways. It first of all has to have a majority of the Swiss people voting in favor of it, and then there are a number of cantons in Switzerland. There has to be a majority of cantons also voting in favor of it, and then it goes into effect. But I think the important point, though, is even if the Swiss Gold Initiative does not pass, gold still wins. It will just mean that the Swiss franc will go to the fiat currency graveyard with all of the other fiat currencies, but gold will still be money.
Yeah, it doesn't change ultimately that fundamental. You're right. I mean, it is the Swiss people's really their last chance to regain some sovereignty and their long-cherished independence. Do you think, James, if I flew over there and got one of those cars with like the big megaphone on top of it, and started driving around talking into it, do you think that would have any impact?
I think they'd probably arrest you.
That's what I'd have to worry about.
Because you'd be breaking various zoning laws in terms of making noise.
Scratch that idea. All right, I'm going to move now to some of the questions that we have in queue. First one comes from Michael, who kind of getting back to the GOFO thing, assuming that it is going to disappear in a little over 2 months. And do you know of any way that individuals can calculate it and publish it themselves to see what's going on?
The only thing you can do is try to get access into a bank trading system. But that's very, very difficult to do for people in the United States, because most banks over here don't want to deal with U.S. citizens anymore, which is another type of capital controls.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, there really isn't. And, if you can't control a market, you try to make the market invisible. And clearly that's what they're trying to do. That's what they tried to do with silver and getting rid of SIFO. And now, apparently they're going to get rid of GOFO as well.
Keep it.
So, sadly, there isn't any other alternative.
Deliberately opaque to keep the game going as long as they can, it seems.
Yeah, there is one thing, though, that you might want to keep an eye on, and this might actually provide a reasonable alternative. If the Shanghai Gold Exchange builds up and takes off as I'm expecting, probably within a short period of time after GOFO closes or no longer is reported in London, you can look at the structure of the spot contract and the forward contracts on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and you'll probably get a good indication of whether we're in backwardation or contango.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is that the Shanghai Gold Exchange is not like the COMEX. If you're trading in spot on the exchange, you actually have to have the physical metal or the cash if you're going to be buying physical metal.
Right.
And if you're delivering, you also have high requirements as well if you're going to trade in a forward contract on that exchange, whether you're delivering or buying. So it will probably be the most visible, closest approximation to what's happening in the physical market.
God forbid, an actual properly organized structure of a commodity market in a communist country. If people ask me all the time, how would I change the COMEX? If I could reform it, that would be it. I mean, that's the first step I would make. Is that you have to take it away from just simply the speculators.
But remember, China is not a communist country.
Well, I suppose.
It's a communist government running a capitalist country.
I guess that's a very good distinction. I appreciate that. That's true. That's true. I want to kind of a follow up question, or like a second question from Michael. He just put these two questions in back to back. Gets to what's going on in the COMEX, and then with some of these miners. You know, the first Majestic CEO was out talking about withholding production because he didn't want to sell it at these non-economic prices. Michael's question is, could we convince miners to take some of their cash flow and actually buy futures? I mean, you can only deliver 1,500 to each account each month, but to buy futures and mine the COMEX instead. We see the huge increase of commercial longs, gross longs, every week in the COT report. Could that be what they're doing? And then I'll add on one thing to Michael's question, so it's kind of a two-parter. Do you think the miners could do that? And then second, somebody suggested to me that maybe what miners should do to help their share price is to begin paying dividends in metal instead of cash. So do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah. With regard to the first one, just again with regard to COMEX, it is a paper market. If you were to try to take large amounts of metal on delivery through the COMEX, you would first be jawboned out of it, and you'd be given all kinds of reasons as to why it shouldn't happen. They'll put stumbling blocks and all kinds of roadblocks in the way to prevent you from taking metal delivery on the COMEX. So I don't really see the COMEX as a viable alternative. And to be honest, I really think it's probably best if people just ignore the COMEX, because it's just a casino run by the insiders for the benefit of the insiders. It's not really, in my mind, a fair and open marketplace with regard to gold and with regard to silver. There are a number of miners that do understand their product, and some have actually bought it. I know IAMGOLD had a large chunk of gold on its balance sheet as liquidity. First Majestic has done that. In the past, Goldcorp did it when Rob McEwen was running Goldcorp. So there are management teams that do understand the metal and its monetary characteristics and what it is that gives the product that they're producing every day value. Mm-hmm. But most miners just don't get it. Either that, or they're too afraid to go against conventional wisdom or what the politicians are saying. And there's some logic to that, in the sense that if you make too many ways, maybe the concession that you got from some government somewhere in the world will be pulled away from you, and your mine is now nationalized and owned by the government. I mean, these things have to be considered when we're living in a world where rule of law has been eroded quite significantly in recent decades.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say, what the miners, to try to get them lined up. I mean, they've had plenty of opportunity to get lined up, but one thing I do know is that the guys that run the mining companies today are not like the guys that I first knew when I got back into the business in the 1960s and 1970s. Guys like Don McLaughlin, who used to run Homestake, that guy intuitively understood gold just like a Chinese person or an Indian person understands gold, that it's money, and understood the implications of what that means for his particular business. But there are very, very few people today in the mining industry that have that deep level of understanding of their product.
What do you think of this idea?
I forgot what the question was that you added to that.
What do you think of the idea of paying a dividend instead of fiat, paying it in metal?
Yeah. We tried to do this in gold money. And it was one of the reasons why IAMGOLD actually invested in gold money, because they intended to pay dividends in gold to their shareholders. And at the end of the day, there are so many roadblocks that have been put into the process by governments that makes it almost difficult, almost impossible to do it.
All right.
What governments have tried to do is they've tried to not only disparage gold with their propaganda, but they've actually put impediments in the way to stop gold from circulating as any kind of currency or as any kind of money.
Remarkable.
It's ideally that would be great, and we've got to get people thinking in terms of money, calculating prices of goods and services in terms of gold, real money, not paper money. But it's just you're up against the forces, the powers that be, and they are powerful. But what they only have so much power, and at the end of the day, all of these promises that they're making, we know they can't be fulfilled. It's just a question when those promises start getting broken, and what promises get broken and what promises get met. So
right.
That's the whole issue of the credit bubble popping.
Remarkable that in a supposedly free society, a company can't pay a dividend however it wants. But that's, a whole other story. Let's see. I'm going to combine two questions. My last remaining email from Phil, but then a question in queue from Robert. Because Phil is concerned, well, not necessarily concerned, but there are all these restrictions now coming into play from the U.S. In dealing with Swiss bank accounts. And he's wondering how that might impact U.S. holders at gold money. And that kind of is what Robert's question is. He says he's got a friend who loves gold money, who can sell a little bit of gold if they want in the evening and have money in their checking account the next day. And if the U.S. instituted some kind of capital control on U.S. dollars, how would the gold money account operate?
Yeah. Well, remember, gold money is a European-based company. And we based gold money in Europe when I first started it, because the U.S. has always been very unfriendly to gold, whereas Europe has historically been friendlier toward gold. And the rule of law has always been a little bit stronger in Europe of late than it was in the United States. So we follow the law in Jersey, which is the island, part of Great Britain, island in the English Channel. And we do whatever Jersey law requires us to do. One of the things that we do with our customers is we ask them, as part of our customer agreement, that they have to be compliant with the laws in the countries where they live and operate. And we have customers in over 100 different countries, and we cannot monitor and control all of the other individual countries. But it's a good question, and it's something that we have to think about. And my answer to it is that, well, you want some gold where you live, but you also want some gold where you don't live, just in case you want to go somewhere else in the world for a period of time until normalcy returns to what your primary country is. When I worked with a big New York bank back in the 1970s, I spent actually most of my life living and working in Asia. And we had in what we called internally in that bank a last plane account. And I was living in Thailand, traveling throughout Southeast Asia, and Vietnam War was going on at the time. The communist menace was threatening, and people were saying, we're worrying about when the Chinese communists were going to come across the border and take Thailand, take the rest of Vietnam, take Burma, take whatever. Everything in Southeast Asia was being questioned at the time. So what the last plane account was is that you would have some kind of nest egg outside of your home country that if the political situation in your own country became uncomfortable for you, you could go with your family and live somewhere else just as comfortably until normalcy returned and you could go back to your home country. And that logic still makes sense. And that's, I think, one of the things that we wanted to do with gold money, that you do have an asset outside of your home country, regardless what country you happen to live. And at the end of the day, we cannot speculate as to what governments will do. Maybe they will allow you to bring your capital back in. Who knows? Maybe they will try to do what Roosevelt did and confiscate your gold in the United States, but make it legal for you to own gold outside the United States.
Right.
When Roosevelt confiscated gold, he only confiscated gold in the U.S. He didn't confiscate gold owned by Americans outside the U.S. That only happened in 1960 under John F. Kennedy. So you just can't speculate as to what politicians may do. And it comes back to what we were discussing earlier, Craig, that you got to have diversification.
Right.
And diversify your assets in as many ways as possible, as many ways as practical, so that at the end of the day, that diversification will help you sleep well at night, knowing that you and your family, you've done the most you possibly can to protect you and your family, come what may.
You're being extremely generous with your time, and I know everybody listening is just enthralled with the conversation because it's just so valuable. If you don't mind, we're about 35 minutes. I want to cram a few more questions in before we begin to wrap up, and I've got a handful still in queue. Jerry wants to know, given your history in dealing with these markets, do you compare this time and this where we are, you know, with paper prices and how they've traded the last couple of years? You compare this to any other time in history that you recall, you know, like the 70s or anything like that?
Well, in some respects, there's some similarities back to the late 1960s and early 1970s, but there's some very important fundamental differences. Never before has government intervention been such a big factor in not only the gold market, but all of the markets that we have today. You know, the key today is, you know, watching what central banks are doing, listening to what they say to see if they actually follow up in action what they're telling us. But government intervention has become such a big factor. I'm not sure that in my lifetime we've ever seen that before. But, you know, when you study monetary history, you do see these clear periods where certain things, you know, repeat. You have these huge credit bubbles that, you know, people, you know, borrow and borrow and banks lend and lend until eventually that debt can no longer be sustained. And we're in a credit bubble, but we don't necessarily recognize it as such because interest rates have been lowered to zero, which means that the U.S. government's budget deficit is much less than if they were paying a fair interest rate on all of the debt that they were borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are some similarities, but there are some major differences. And I think one of the big differences, aside from government intervention, is I've never seen gold really so out of favor. My mathematical models show that gold was more out of favor in July of 1999, before we started, you know, the big bull market in the first part of the century. Mathematically, that was lower. But just everything I've seen and heard, sentiment-wise and everything else, even though the mathematical models show it lower back then, I think gold is cheaper now today than it was, you know, back in July of 1999.
Yeah, but in the end, really kind of unprecedented more than anything else, it sounds like, with what you're saying.
Yeah, it really is unprecedented. And that was the thing about the money bubble that John Rampina and I had written about. You know, we are in a bubble, but when you're in a bubble, you don't necessarily know it. But there are conventional wisdoms that are accepted that can you can identify to show that you are in a bubble. For example, in the dot-com bubble, everybody was saying that profits didn't matter, only market share did. And after that bubble popped, everybody realized how silly it was, some of these dot-com companies and what the conventional wisdom was. In the real estate bubble, everybody said housing prices only go up, they don't go down. After that bubble popped, everybody realized how silly that conventional wisdom was. And today, the money bubble is that people don't realize that what we're using today as what they call as money is not really money in the historical sense. It's a money substitute circulating in place of money. Money is a tangible asset because the way civilization works and the way society grows and develops is that assets, goods and services are paid for with goods and services. In other words, you have assets to pay for other assets. You go out and work, and that labor that you're expending to get some kind of money to go and buy goods and services to raise your standard of living, you know, meet your family's needs and wants. When you go out and pay for something with credit, you're not actually paying for something. The guy who takes your piece of paper and gives you the good or service has payment risk. And that's what the money bubble is all about. Everybody's thinking that credit pays for goods and services, but it doesn't. And this huge debt bubble has been created as a consequence.
Yep.
And, you know, honest, Craig, I think this debt bubble is bigger than any of the other ones that we've seen in history. You know, Mississippi bubble, South Sea bubble, Tulip Mania bubble, 1929. You know, this one is bigger than all of them because of government intervention.
And going to make a bigger pop when it goes, that's for sure. A question from Dave, and we'll kind of combine. He's got a couple of them here I'm going to try to combine. In that, you know, we talk about gold price and supply demand. One of the things that we do not always talk about is supply or how much existing supply there is in the world. So Dave wants to know, you mentioned the World Gold Council kind of diverging and being wrong all the time, and Koos Jansen's done a good job of exposing them lately too. So would you agree that the total amount of gold in the world is far more than the far more or less, I guess, than the 170,000 metric tons or whatever it is that they try to say there is. And then Dave further goes on to say, if there really are, I mean, how would you compare the amount of gold that's readily available versus the amount of silver? I mean, is one, I guess, more scarce than the other?
Yeah. First of all, I did a pamphlet or a monograph about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I can't remember now, called The Above-Ground Gold Stock, Its Importance and Its Size. It's available for free on the internet. If you Google it or if you find it, you can go to the Gold Money website and download it from the Gold Money website. And what I did is I went back through history and showed what was mined and showed how the growth of the above-ground gold stock was consistent, about 1.75% per year per annum growth, which is why gold has consistency of purchasing power over long periods of time. So, for example, an ounce of gold today buys the same amount of crude oil it did back in 1950. It's only the dollar has been debased and lost purchasing power, but gold maintains purchasing power over long periods of time. And in that study that I completed back then, it showed that there was a lot less gold in the world than what the World Gold Council was saying. And the reason for that discrepancy is that the World Gold Council assumed that in 1492 there was 15,000 tons of gold in the above-ground gold stock, which is just totally ridiculous based on a number of measures that I put in that report. So right now the above-ground gold stock is closer to 165,000 metric tons, whereas the Gold Council is saying it's up near 177 or 178. There's about a 14,000 ton difference between the two. One other thing on this regard, there's all this talk about Yamashita's gold in Asia that he confiscated when the Japanese pillaged Southeast Asia. These stories are all bunk. They're just disinformation to try to get people to think that there's a lot more gold than there really is in the world.
Right.
If you've ever been in a South African gold mine and you've gone down 3 kilometers and see what these guys are doing to get gold out of the ground, you'll realize how scarce and how rare gold really is.
Yeah.
So these stories of huge amounts of gold floating around in Asia, and various things called Black Lily Trust and stuff, the trust may exist. They may have dollars in it, but it doesn't have the huge amounts of gold that people say.
I'm with you on that. Just a couple of other questions, and then we'll wrap up and get to the final four. A lot of folks just want to get your opinion on these news stories this week about the terrorist organization ISIS coining and minting their own gold and silver money. And what do you think about that? I mean, are the Western governments setting that up as some type of scheme or hoping that they do something like that as some sort of scheme so that we can all be branded as terrorists, anyone that owns gold? I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, that is a concern. You do have to look at what the government motivation might be behind it, particularly given that some people say that ISIS was originally funded by the CIA. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I did live in the Middle East for a number of years, and as a consequence, I did study Islamic law a little bit and Islamic culture. I'm not a scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but I do know a little bit about Sharia law, which is an important part of Islam. It relates to finance in Islam. And under Sharia law, the only true money is gold and silver coins. So I'm not too surprised that this Islamic organization would go back to gold and silver coin. And if you recognize that up until 1968, only gold and silver coins circulated in Saudi Arabia and most of the Gulf states, you sort of understand the importance of gold and silver in Islamic culture.
So it's a logical thing for them to do, I guess, in some regards. I mean, it's
a logical thing for them to do. Unfortunately, it may have negative consequences for people in the West who like gold because we might be branded as a terrorist, but you just have to sort of see through the government propaganda and understand what's really happening. If there is some terrorist propaganda that comes out, you can always go back to what the framers of the Constitution said about gold and silver, just to counteract anything the government might be saying today.
You mean Ben Al Franklin and George Muhammad Washington, those guys?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, finally, just one more here. Michael wants to know, you know, there's going to be a G20 meeting over the weekend where it certainly appears that the G20 is going to formalize some language in making bank deposits, moving them farther down the list of priorities when a bank gets or bank goes insolvent. So anyway, it looks to me, at least, or to many folks, that this is the institutionalizing of the bail-in process globally. Any thoughts on that?
I agree. You know, banks and the governments that work hand in glove with one another, they're going to do everything they can to maintain this position of power that they've worked themselves into over the last 100 years or so.
Yep.
And this is just another logical progression of screwing the middle class.
Yep.
And you know, stealing and taking away, you know, from the middle class. So yeah, you have to expect that, you know, bail-ins are going to be coming because the banks are way over leveraged. They have far too many bad loans. And that doesn't even get into this mountain of derivatives that they built.
Yeah. And by writing this, you know, in law across the whole G20 in some shape or form, it sure seems like this idea is now going to be widespread and, like I said, institutionalized.
Yeah, I think Ayn Rand says something about, you know, when they come for your money, they're going to write laws to make them the sound like they're on the high moral ground. But the reality is it's not. You have to go back to the basics, go back to, you know, the thinking that prevailed for, you know, the first 100, at least the first 100 years, maybe even a little bit longer in the United States, and, you know, what money is and the importance of sound money to sound economic activity.
And to freedom and liberty.
And personal freedom, yeah. In fact, I was just in Munich delivering a speech at a big gold conference there, and I explained 5 different reasons why gold had value. You know, and I focused on 5 factors of usefulness, and the 5th one, which you don't hear too much in gold conferences, but in my mind is very important, and maybe it's really it should have been the first one, is that gold is a defender of human freedom. And I like to refer to a speech that Warren Buffett's father, Howard Buffett, who was a congressman from Omaha back in the late 1940s. He gave the speech in 1948. He clearly understood the importance of gold in a society where you have human freedom.
No doubt about it. And that, and we certainly all appreciate all that you've done to help that cause, James. And yeah, we very much appreciate all your time this morning. You've been, like I said, extremely generous. And it's just been very, very helpful to hear your thoughts on all these subjects. But I think
it's always a pleasure to turn into Turdville. I mean, you know, you've got some great reports coming out. You do some really great research, and so I'm always happy to answer any questions that your followers may have.
Well, thank you. We have a tradition here as we wrap up these webinars of what I call the final four, just 4 quick questions that can usually be answered with a one word or a sentence or something really quick. So if you're ready, can I lay them on you?
Yeah, fire away.
All right. Your bio lists that you are a graduate of George Washington University. So how well do you know your school, your alma mater? What is the mascot at George Washington?
I don't have a clue. All I know about George Washington is that what I learned in economics at that school was total rubbish.
Well, I think that's even better because some of us, you know, have college age or soon to be college age kids. That's stuff we need to know. To refresh your memory, they're the George Washington Colonials. So,
yeah, that brings back memories.
So there you go. All right. Kind of a follow-up question is number 2. You graduated in 1969. Did you head straight from there and go to Woodstock?
No, I went straight from there to Wall Street and was on the training program with Chase Manhattan Bank. And shortly thereafter went to Thailand.
Summer of Love was not your deal, huh? You weren't sitting there smoking doobie in the mud?
No, but I was listening to the music. And, yeah, I went to school in Washington at a great time. There was a lot going on. It was good fun. So didn't get up to Woodstock, though.
Fair enough. All right. Now, most folks know that you're an American expat, I guess, in a sense, and that you live in Europe. A lot of folks like from here like to go to Europe to vacation. But since you live in Europe, where do you go for vacation?
Well, I was just in Australia, actually. I was speaking at a conference and combined it into a two-week trip. And my wife and I went up to a place called Port Douglas, went scuba diving on the Great Barrier Reef, went to Hunter Valley, did some wine tours in the Hunter Valley, and had a really good time. So I travel a lot for personal reasons, you know, just to see the world. But when I take a holiday, we have a house in the mountains in New Hampshire. We go back there in July and August, and that's my holiday.
There you go. There you go. Now, and I'm going to substitute a different question into what I had from number four, because you mentioned to me before we got started about taking vacation to Spain to golf.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that you're a golfer, and being that international Renaissance man that I mentioned earlier, you know, with connections in Switzerland, if you had one golf course that you've gone to and played globally, that you could just go back to right now and tee it up and go, what course would that be?
Nawatani in Bangkok, Thailand.
Really? No, that's not an answer I was expecting. What can you tell everybody about that?
Great course. I can't remember who designed it. It was one of the big names. It may have been I can't remember who designed it, but it was just a great course. I loved playing it, played it quite a bit, and it was always well manicured. And it was just fun. You know, you'd go play the course, you'd get some fresh coconut at the little fruit stands at the various places, or, you know, the fresh fruit that the vendors would serve as you're playing around the golf. It was just a really great course.
That's fun. That's tremendous. The name of it again in Bangkok is what?
Nawatani.
No, I'm not even going to try to spell that. I think I'll just Google Bangkok golf course.
I'm not sure how to spell it. And I'm not sure if it's still the great course it used to be. You know, I played it back there years ago, so it may have changed, but I really have fond memories. Some
sure
of the best
enough.
Golf I've ever played.
I've got quite a few comments here of people that have been listening that want to thank you in bold capital letters for spending the time and what a great presentation this has been. But before we go, tell everybody once again about your book, why they should read it, and then one more time about Gold Money and why they should use it.
Yeah, first of all, Gold Money, you know, we have 23,000 customers around the world. We're storing over $1 billion of precious metals owned by those customers in different vaults located around the world, Canada, UK, Switzerland, Singapore, and Hong Kong. What those different vaults do is they give you diversification. I mean, you obviously want to have some gold where you live, but how much are you going to store in your backyard?
Yeah.
You want to have some professional storage. And if you do use professional storage, you want to make sure that it has the governance procedures that we have at Gold Money, you know, the independent audits, the insurance. We even scan bars of gold with ultra scanning to make certain that they're really gold, gold bars and not just gold-plated tungsten. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, Gold Money has done so well. We provide the assurances of integrity that your gold and silver are safe. And the book, it's the second book that John Rubino and I wrote together. The first one was The Collapse of the Dollar, which was very successful. The two key themes of that book when it came out in 2004 were buy gold and bet against the housing bubble. And this new book called The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops, it's basically following on from that first book, but bringing everything up to date based on current circumstances. And it focuses specifically on money and currency and the problems that we face today.
It's great stuff. Having read it, you were very kind to mail it to me when it first came out, and it's tremendous, and I would encourage everybody. It's still very relevant. It was even fresh. I remember reading it, and there were passages in there about stuff that had happened maybe only 4 or 5 weeks earlier. So it's still relevant. It's not like stuff, you know, you wrote 10 years ago, and it's a great.
Yeah, it only came out earlier this year.
Yeah, I'd encourage everybody to do it. And again, you can, as a Gold Money client, you can choose where you want your bullion held, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, how can you beat that? And everybody should know, Gold Money was one of the very first affiliations that I announced here at TFMR. You can access, you can just go to the store, hit the store tab in the nav bar, and you'll see our list of affiliations, and Gold Money is probably one of them. And I want to thank them for all they do. And James, thank you for all you do. This is and for spending time with us today. It's been
okay. Thanks a lot. It's been great speaking with you.
Good travels to you, and hopefully we can do this again in the new year.
Okay, be happy to do it. Thanks.